Join us this Saturday for an all-new episode of The Athletic NBA Show, Saturday Slam and Jam, hosted by me, Andrew Schlecht. I'll be joined by my co-hosts Alex Spears and many of the Athletic beat writers that you know and love. We will recap the week of the NBA, play some NBA trivia, and just overall talk about the league that we love most. So while you're flipping your flapjacks, tending to your yard, or just sipping your coffee on Saturday morning, listen to Saturday Slam and Jam on the Athletic NBA Show.
Roger, TV circuit breakers in. Space 5 square. Roger. And we're getting a picture on the TV.
Yeah, go for it.
Inside, and Howard with the finish. Gian Wall to the basket. Oh, what a block by LeBron James.
Here comes the United States with numbers. Paul, pretty pass. And James the finish. Oh!
Woo! That gets the crowd up on its feet.
As it's taken away from him, LeBron James is just stronger than everybody. As Ray dunks it and a foul.
Set up in terms of playing hard, but you don't necessarily have to do that.
That's different. It's a big commitment as Wade gets up.
Up and under and puts it in.
Welcome to the House of Strauss on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Stars hang with stars, winners hang with winners.
Si un jour tu m'emmènes à la plage, je me retends plongé dans les vagues. Je te promets que je resterai sage, mais tu ne comprends pas que je rêve de ça.
Welcome to the House of Strauss Podcast. I am ecstatic. I am so pleased to be joined by the legendary Jack McCallum and the equally legendary J.A. Adonde, who are both working on, and let me unravel the scroll of the title of the podcast. Let me unspool this. The Dream Team Tapes, Season 2, Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team, which I think it's number one on number one new sports podcast of 2020, and it's on a subject that I am really, I think it's a well-chosen subject. I think it's perfect because and I'm just launching into it before the pleasantries and asking you any human questions about how you're doing, but I like recent histories. I think that there's a lot left on the table. When you go back, the statute of limitations fades quickly, and this team, I do think, is very important in the grand sweep of international basketball, and I'm just very pleased to talk to both of you, but okay, human questions. How you doing? How are things? What's going on?
It's a miserable day in Chicago.
Bill Vertical, I've been spending a lot of time looking at J.A. on Zoom calls, more than I've seen my wife over the last 7 or 8 weeks, but it's been a very, I suppose I could lie, but I'm not lying. It's been a great experience doing it. It took us a while, I think, Jay, to try to figure it out, like how to tell the story. There's 50 ways to tell the story, and I think we got it figured out. And the fact that we do has made this, a pleasurable experience, at least for me.
Yeah, Jack. Ultimately, we followed the reporting, right? And what the people that we talked to told us reshaped our notion of what we thought the story was going to be. I think we had one thought and one plan going in, and then the more we talked to people, it changed the trajectory of what we did. One key point of delineation was when Jack was able to talk or convince Phil Jackson to talk to us. And Phil gave us a great hour talking about the whole arc of his relationship with Kobe Bryant, and that caused a pretty significant reset of how we were going to plot this out and plan it. So we decided to dedicate the entire second episode to Kobe, and we heard a lot of Phil Jackson in that one. And to your point, Ethan, it's just the right amount of distance to have some perspective and for the people to understand, the participants to understand and to place that moment in time and a little bit where they feel a little more candid with us, and they can talk about some of the things that happened behind closed doors and joke about them. Maybe they were arguments that they got into at the time that now they can laugh about. And so all of those things, I think, make it an ideal time to tell this story.
Well, and it seems like USA basketball dominance is taken for granted until it isn't. And because of the success of this team and subsequent teams, it is forgotten that it was unraveling, that there was a humiliation in Greece, and there needed to be this huge project undertaken to fix everything. And I want to drill down on that, but I also am curious about what you said earlier. What did you think this story was going to be, JA, versus what you discovered it was?
So originally, my thought, I didn't know where to go with it at first, because it was a sequel to the Dream Team tapes, which, as the name implied, Jack had everyone from all the major players, at least from the Dream Team, on tape for the book that he did. And, you know, so that had a very natural thing. Okay, we'll play the audio and you'll hear from the Dream Team. We had no guarantee who we'd be able to speak to, at least from the player perspective. So we didn't start with audio. So we were starting from the outside, and Jack was confident that we could get Jerry Colangelo and Mike Krzyzewski, two key architects of this Redeem team. But we didn't know how much or if we could get anyone else to tell their story, and how we were going to be able to get audio to build this audio tale. So that was one thing. And then I thought we could look at it and tell the parallel stories of Kobe and USA basketball, because it seems like the four-year intervals sort of align closely to the four-year intervals of Kobe's career. 1996 Olympics is Kobe's rookie year. 2000 Olympics is Kobe's first championship. 2008 Olympics is Kobe's MVP. So we thought we'd kind of go along that way. And then, like I said, once we talked to Phil Jackson, it really reset things. And so we scrapped that idea a little bit. And we basically condensed the history prior to 2004. We did covered all of that in the first episode, whereas originally I think we were going to take two or three episodes to get through all that.
We started out listening to games, and like I'm talking now, this is before we recorded an episode, and we were going, hey, this happened in the China game, and this happened. Well, so far we haven't talked about a game, so everything has changed so much. I mean he's right about Phil, but then in twice within a couple days, J.A. got Jason Kidd through the Lakers and got Carmelo. And as soon as you do that, you realize that in these podcasts, your own voice is necessary to tie the story to, but it's so much better if you have other people telling the story and you don't know what they're going to say. I was amazed at how candid people were. Like, J.A. Kidd was more candid in this thing than at any other point during the years I was covering him. He told about this Kobe being late. It's coming up in an episode, but Kobe being late to a party, a team function in Macau, and they left his ass, back at the hotel, and then had to decide whether he would have never said that back at the time. So as you said, as we talked about perspective, giving him perspective and space to kind of talk about it was a really important thing.
Yeah. I mean, this is just going to be a fascinating saga, and on multiple levels. I think the Redeem team is recognized as ground zero for the Miami Heat dynasty getting created. Right. Did you learn anything about the origins? What?
Well, that was one thing that we came in thinking that, and that we might even dedicate a whole episode to that. And one thing we discovered universally, including Chris Bosh, told us that, no, it really wasn't born out of that. That they had their connections prior to that. And then all the other players we talked to, Darren Williams, Carmelo, they said, no, we didn't notice that they were particularly hanging. So there is no one who says that the time that they spent together specifically with that team is what led to the Miami Heat Big Three. But that was certainly a thesis or a hypothesis that we had coming in, but nothing in our reporting bore that out.
That's ironic. Well, maybe not ironic, but it's funny because I do think that Durant, Iguodala and Curry in Turkey, were they all over there? Or maybe it was just Curry and Durant. I do think that was the founding that meant something as far as the Warriors dynasty being formed, but history doesn't remember it that way. But Jack, you were saying.
Well, I do think that they found, I know this sounds vague and it's somewhat described, I do think that they kind of found their voice there together. You know, Carmelo talked about that a little bit. I mean, at the time, you know, Bosch was laughing. Hey, I was trying to get their ass to Toronto. You know, that would have been nice. Carmelo's trying to get him to Denver. But I do think they found this bond that was made, particularly between LeBron, Carmelo, Chris Paul, and D-Wade. I don't think it's an accident that years later they found themselves on an ESPY stage. Or it might have happened anyway, but I do think, don't you agree, J.A., that it was there that they sort of found their kind of collective power, even if they didn't say, hey, 4 or 5 years from now, we're going to be winning NBA championships together.
Yeah, well, they came in together, at least LeBron and Carmelo and D-Wade came in that same 2003 draft, and we talk about that in the third episode. So there was that. They had known each other through the AAU circuits. And I think what this did was it did allow them to spend more time together, to play together, to see what it looked like to be on the same team. And maybe to think about something bigger than themselves. Mike Krzyzewski was really big on that, the notion of playing for your country. And so Carmelo disputed this with me a little bit when I wondered if that time playing for Team USA led to that moment Jack referenced on the ESPY stage at a really critical juncture, it felt like, in our country for that year. Carmelo said no, that was really more his personal thoughts, and he thought that would have happened with or without their Team USA experience. But you can't deny that time counted for something, that if you look at how many times they spent, particularly in uniform, how many times have they spent together on a court and in uniform and wearing the same uniform? And that came as a result of USA basketball.
Yeah. And what's a little bit forgotten, and I'd even really forgotten about it, is that these guys had some contact with one another in that shameful 2004 disaster, right? I'd totally forgotten about that. And you covered a bit that LeBron and Wade were on that Athens team. As rookies, and that they had to wear this weird international failure as a result of it. What did you guys learn going into that and doing your interviews on it?
Well, I covered those Olympics, and they were as bad as we remember. The greatest line from there was Tommy Shepard, who's now the Washington Wizards general manager, so he has to watch his tongue a little bit. Tommy was over there as a USA basketball representative. Puerto Rico nipped the United States in the first game by 19 points. Mm. And Tommy Shepard goes by me and goes, well, we were in it till the tip. And can you imagine an international basketball situation just 12 years after the Dream Team that Carlos Arroyo, nothing against Carlos, had a nice career, like ties you in knots. And it was at those 2004 games when we realized we needed a program. And the quotes we got from Wade and LeBron were on press conferences about it. And Carmelo, we talked about it. Yeah, there was a real thrown together. What's going on? We don't have this program together. There's no unity. That's what that team felt like to them. And that resulted, and we saw what that result was, that we can no longer pick somebody from column A and somebody from column B and put them there with a coach from column C, and everything is going to work out. So 2004 was extremely important, and they understood the chaotic nature of it, particularly since it was compared to the way the program then started to take off after under Colangelo and Mike Krzyzewski.
J.A., what were the things Colangelo did to change things and to redirect it all?
So for one, fundraising. He's a master fundraiser, and so he tripled or quadrupled I forget what the number was. He started $9 million and then he, I think they got to, that was the previous budget, and he got it up to like, was it 36 or something, 30 Jack?
Million. He got it up to 30 million.
And so that's something he does really well. The interesting thing was that he took control. So he centralized the power, but he also got a lot of input. And there's something we jokingly call the meeting of the five families that he convened in Chicago. And so he gets Larry Bird, Michael Jordan, John Thompson, Dean Smith, Jerry West, all these legendary players who had a connection with Olympic basketball over the decades, and convenes them to get their input on where we should go. So even though he singularly focused, he sought this input from this all-star group of consultants that he put together. And I think those are two big things. But just centralizing it, and he's a guy, as we talk about, I think that's episode 4, Jack, the Godfather, that he just gets things done, he puts things together, and he makes it happen. And all those things came true with him in charge.
Well, he went to guys and he got a 3-year, one of the mysteries of me, and I've known Jerry a long time. And even since I started covering the league, you know, back in the early 80s. And he's a very, I wouldn't like to have sit down and have a 15-minute political conversation probably with Jerry, or a combination of, or, you know, talk about music or the culture. But he has this amazing ability to relate, like Darren Williams was talking about. Yeah, I knew Jerry. You know, we had a University of Illinois connection. I said to Darren, he went there in the 50s. You know, what's your connection? You know, but he can talk to these guys. And one of the things he did, one of the things I said in the episode was, Jerry goes back to, he was recruited. He was a good player. It turned out to be a good player in the Big Ten. He was recruited to play at the University of Kansas with Wilt Chamberlain. And wow. Wilt left to go to the Globetrotters, and Jerry said, you know, I don't think we're going to be very good without Wilt. And so he went to the University of Illinois. Anyway, he has this ability in the same way J.A. and I have talked about. I'm pretty sure Jerry West is the only other guy you can fit into this who has maintained this ability to stay relevant, no matter what he thought about the way people dressed, or the way they listen to music, or the way they had tattoos, or the way the game has transferred to three-point shots. No matter what they thought about that, they rolled with it. And Carmelo went to all these guys, but the big ones being, you know, LeBron, D-Wade, Kobe's a little bit of a more complicated story, and got a 3-year commitment to be on this team, which is a large commitment to get from guys in this day and age.
What do you attribute that to, the ability to stay relevant? Because it's an uncommon skill, and it seems that most people, at least in this industry, they get to a certain age, and maybe Phil Jackson is one of these guys where he reaches a certain point and he's just not with it. What did Colangelo have that allowed him to stay on the vanguard?
I'm trying to figure it out because I'm that age.
It's a different game. And by the way, I would say you're doing it right. I mean, this is the way to do it.
I join up with podcasting. J.A.'s 20 years younger and you're 30. So, you know, that's how I'm doing it.
No, but you're
Jack,
doing
I,
it right.
I think it's about he looks ahead. And I'm not sure I have the exact answer to your question, Ethan. But one thing I've known from being around Colangelo, the time I've spent, is that he is thinking about what comes next and what we need to do this next. And I think he successfully incorporates what has worked in the past while understanding that you can't always continue to do things the same way. Yeah. But he knows what's worked. He has a method that has proven to be effective for him. But I think he's continuously thinking about what the market needs next. And so I think that's what worked with his approach to USA Basketball, was obviously what the way USA Basketball had done it wasn't working anymore. So he had an idea and a notion for what we need to do now. And one of the big things he needed was a multi-year commitment and a sense of both camaraderie in competition, that you weren't guaranteed a spot on the team. You were going to have to earn it and prove it. So that was a major fundamental shift. And that was something that this old school guy brought to USA Basketball that was able to revamp it going forward. And Jack, I think you agree that there's going to be a need for another shift. Now, at this more juncture that we're at right now, if USA Basketball wants to stay on top, they're going to have to think of what's next.
Yeah, I don't want to get in too much of a tangent, but and get away from the subject material. But I do think there's something here that's worth probing, because I'm not just bullshitting you when I say that you're doing it right, because it is a different terrain. And I think what's interesting to me about it is the hunger for the past. And so, and not just the recent past, but also the 1990s, as I'm sure, J.A., you noticed that when you were involved in the Last Dance documentary, and how excited people are about that. So there is something interesting happening right now where the recent past is more popular than the present. And I'm wondering if that's caught either of you guys by surprise, because I think we all assume that we have to stay out ahead of things and look at what's next. But that doesn't seem to be where the appetite is currently.
Yeah, I think the key guy going forward, and I'm not the first one to suggest this, but there's going to have to be a let's call it the Magic Michael of 92 got people, okay, hey, this is cool, we're going to do this. Because nobody knew before the Dream Team was, here I am going back to it, by the way, but nobody knew who was going to do this. I mean, the initial assumption was Jordan ain't going to do this. He's going to play golf. Magic's still working on his business. But Magic said, I'm in, man. And you go back then after the 2004, LeBron said, I'm in. Kobe said, okay, I'm in. We're going to need an I'm in guy. And it's probably going to have to be somebody like Zion Williamson. Somebody that is going to have to, yeah, you can have all the Jerry Colangelos you want. You can have a great coach in Popovich. But somebody's going to have to make it important, not cool, but important and crucial to remain on that level, to give up some summers, to pay homage to the idea of playing for your country. And you're better off to decide this than who I am. But certainly Zion's one of those guys, and he's going to need some other guys. And if you don't have them, it's going to be very difficult to replicate what happened.
You're right about that. I think that's a very correct call. I also think that the surrounding climate and culture also informs a lot of this. And I think that, frankly, America felt a lot better about itself in 2008 and also in the 1990s than right now. And you can just look at polling, Gallup polling. There's been a rough go of it. I don't think people exactly have their chests puffed out with sports nationalism. I think 2008 Redeem Team might have been one of the last throws. Obviously, we had the women's soccer team recently doing very well, and people were quite excited about that. So it wasn't the last one of those, but it just doesn't. It doesn't seem like there's as much of a prideful represent your country sort of attitude currently. And I say that without judgment. That's just more of an observation. And so
you think about the makeup of the NBA now. And so if we're going to take the top players, so in 1992, you take the top players in the NBA and automatically they're representing USA Basketball, with the exception of Hakeem Olajuwon, who actually a few years later came around to represent the USA after he became a citizen. But right now, if we take the two-time defending most valuable player, he can't play for USA. Giannis Antetokounmpo, he's Greek. The Luka Doncic, he can't play for USA. Nikola Jokic. I don't know Embiid's citizenship status. I was just wondering that. I don't know, but he might be Cameroon. So all these players that come to mind who you'd want to pick, you can't. And that's the legacy of the Dream Team, right? That helped create all of these great and inspire all these great international players. Well, now we're dealing with the side effect of that, and that you could argue three of the five best players in the world aren't American, or whatever mixture you want to take. But, look at the top 10 players in the NBA right now. How many of them are not eligible to play for USA Basketball?
It's a great point. And that 2008 Redeem Team, I would encourage anybody to just go on YouTube and check out some of the highlights. That seemed to be, I don't know if that was a high watermark of NBA talent or American NBA talent. Obviously, people would look to that 1992 team, but it's incredible. I mean, it is a moment of time, a moment in time of the NBA that's special. You've got Chris Paul pre-knee injury. You've got LeBron at just
peak athletic LeBron,
yeah,
I would say.
Peak athletic LeBron, and Wade too. Kobe at the absolute height of his powers. Just at least the perimeter talent, certainly. I think the perimeter talent of that team better than the Dream Team overall. As when you think about where those guys were in their careers. And the NBA is just not going to replicate that anytime soon, at least in terms of American talent.
Well, I think the one thing that would make it by 2 years later, the World Championship team, which I actually covered over in Istanbul, the one guy that would put that way over the edge was Durant. And, you know, KD was on the 12 and 16 teams, and he was incredible in international ball. I don't know who he would substitute for, but probably, you know, Dwight Howard. KD was only, he was coming off a rookie year then, right, too. I think he came in 07. And I do not remember the exact reason he wasn't considered for 08. I'm sure they didn't think he needed him. But when KD came aboard, you know, you had a rebounder, you had a guy who you could isolate and get a basket from, you had a pretty good defender, and you had a three-point shooter as good as anybody, just about, you know, maybe a couple of guys from Spain. So if you had him, and they did in 2012, but they didn't have Pete Kobe, you're talking about a team that could really give the Dream Team a challenge. That's obviously an episode JA and I are going to talk about later.
I think one of the issues that the team has, and this has been a frustration of mine, and you can disabuse me of this theory if it's wrong. I feel like NBC, because they own the Olympics but no longer own the rights to NBA basketball, has been sandbagging the promotion of Team USA basketball. And it's a competing product for them. Or, I mean, I need to see what the hell the terms are of the new hockey deal that was just signed. But at least recently, they've had the NHL, not the NBA. And those sports are on same time of year. You watch the Winter Olympics. It is all about the hockey all the time. They are just ramming that down your throat because it's cross promotion for them, for their league. I feel like they've been trying to hide Team USA, and you hear a lot of bullshit excuses that, oh, people don't want to watch that in the Olympics. They want to watch a guy swimming, and that's what they want to watch. You know, no. Americans during the Olympics like watching their guys smack the hell out of the other guys. And so I think that's been a problem for Team USA in the post-NBC having the NBA rights era. Is you've got these great stories, you've got this dominance, the team is compelling, and we're not necessarily being made to see it.
There's something to that. Yeah, Ethan, the other thing is, you know, this year it's going to be a quick turnaround. So you wonder, I think LeBron has passed his Team USA days, but I'm trying to think again. I'm running into a lot of the best players aren't American born, but you know, who's going to want to go if they play in the NBA Finals? Who's going to want to turn around and head to Tokyo? They're going to need a break. And then in the future, how is if we're going to start the NBA season later and it's going to go deeper into the summer and it's either going to directly conflict with the Olympic schedule or it's going to leave very short recovery time for the best players and teams after the finals and before the Olympics starts. So that's could have a major impact on the composition of USA basketball teams.
Yeah. Jack, you were saying?
You know, nobody will. I think you're absolutely right that the promotion of the team, and even if they manage to win, if there is a Tokyo Olympics, we're talking in March, I guess they're going to be. I tell you what, it'll get lost, but I'll tell you what won't be. If we end up getting skunked, that'll get noticed.
Yeah.
And you know, that's what happened in 2004. J.A. and I spent a lot of time talking about that on the podcast and off the podcast. And like I said, I covered that team. That team had this, whether it was race or whatever else, they, people were not only pissed off at them, they reviled that team. You know, they didn't, you know, they just hated that team. And because they lost and because they didn't look like other teams, they didn't have, you know, Michael, you know, they didn't have my,
do you think it's centered around Iverson? Do you think a lot of it was Iverson backlash?
Yeah. And we talked about that. I know it was around Iverson and I was over there. Iverson couldn't have been, they could have wrapped Iverson in red, white, and blue. That guy was like, after every game, it's an honor to be here, played his ass off, you know, in opposed to the great team player of all time, Tim Duncan, who was, you know, not very good at all during those Olympics. But no matter what he said, or no matter how he performed, it was, look how many tattoos Iverson has, and what has our Olympic program come to that we not only can't win, but Allen Iverson is our leader. And it was totally a cultural type of determination. You
know, and Tim Duncan really has slid, now that I think about it, where he complained about FIBA. He didn't really come back to the program, if memory serves. And nobody really blames him. It's kind of incredible.
Yeah, during those times, and Pop was the assistant. And, you know, Duncan could have kind of taken over, probably should have taken over that team a little bit. As we said, LeBron's young, D-Wade's young, Melo's young, Iverson's great, but he's limited. You know, he's not rebounding or locking down on defense. It should have been Tim's team. And I was there, and it was not. And Iverson tried to play his butt off to make it his team, but the world had gotten too big, had too good, and it was just everything else around him just was not working in those Olympics.
And Ethan, it's going to be interesting going forward as the culture wars play out in the Olympics and with USA Basketball, in that you're going to have a certain set that is going to be opposed to basketball players. You're going to have a group that fancies themselves very patriotic, that remembers these NBA players as the ones who had Black Lives Matter on the court in the bubble and Black Lives Matter on their jerseys and LeBron James calling the president a bum and teams not going to the White House after they won championships, all of that. And so now if they lose, what's going to happen?
Jeering is what it's going to be. Schadenfreude, I think, is what's going to happen.
Right. Yeah. So this team that has represented us so well throughout the decades, what, Jack, two defeats in all the Olympics for USA men's basketball? Two times they didn't win the gold medal? Three times. So 72, 88, and 2004. Yeah. Right. So, I mean, it's really easy to think of the times they didn't. That's how rare it is. So this team, which has been great, which has represented so well, which has, you know, brought home gold medal after gold medal, won't necessarily have the entire country behind them for the near future.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Yeah, that is a shift. I think there has been a cultural divorce. It's not that there's anything new, but I think it's a matter of degree. And people who are angry at the 2004 result, many of those people instead would delight in a result, in a similar result, and as opposed to being angry, quite enjoy it. I do think that is something that will happen under certain conditions, but that is a reality right now. That's just where it's at. And maybe we're locked in a particular moment in time. Maybe it has to do with the Trump era. And after the Trump era, tensions cool and the country comes back together to a certain extent. But at least right now, that is the state of play, I believe.
Yeah, and I don't think, you know, the pandemic era is not helping anything. If you ask me right now what's going on in, the trials, for example, the Olympic trials, which are always a big thing, how are they going to conduct them? You know, it's just a product of its, and unfortunately, it falls on, you know, someone who has been loyal to this whole thing, and that's Popovich. You know, going back to J.A. was talking about this meeting that Jerry Colangelo convened. I mean, if you recall, in 2005, they're trying to figure out who to pick as coach. And we talk about it in the next episode, right, Jay? Or we talk about it in Colangelo. But,
episode four, yeah.
Yeah.
The or five.
You know, the decision to pick Krzyzewski, as well known as he was, like the supreme college coach, I think he's probably, beside John Wooden, you know, Mike's on that platform, to pick him over Pop, who had already won a couple NBA championships by them, was a counterintuitive decision. So I hope Pop, who I've ever always found delightful as well as infuriating to cover, I hope
terrifying at times, right, Jack?
Yeah, I hope he gets. A shot to do this kind of team that can win.
What informed that choice, other than sneaky Nike machinations? If you're a conspiracy theorist, what informed the choice of Krzyzewski over Popovich?
Tell him,
personal relationships. Yeah, so it comes down to Colangelo was certainly willing to give Popovich a shot and recognized everything that Popovich could bring to the table in his previous service in the 2004 Olympics as an assistant. And they get on the phone and he just doesn't sense a level of enthusiasm that he wanted to get from Popovich. And so he just says, this isn't the guy. And later Colangelo apologized because he was very candid about that. He publicly said, well, I didn't get the sense that Pop was really into it. And Popovich called him up and said, hey, that's just kind of how I am. It doesn't mean I didn't want to take the job. And so Colangelo later apologized. And Colangelo told us, and he's told other people, that he felt he misread Popovich. But that's what happened.
Whether
he got the right read or not. Yeah. It's kind of a good lesson in life that you never know, or you only get one chance at a first impression, right? So they just got off on the wrong foot. And that's one reason Greg Popovich didn't coach his team earlier.
They had some wrong feet before that. I mean, you know, longtime Suns Spurs rivalry. But what was happening with Pop at the time that Colangelo wasn't sensitive enough to realize was Pop is coming off the frustration and disappointment and disillusionment of being an assistant on the 04 team. So all as he's doing, he's kind of venting about what happened in 04. We can't do this shit again. So it came across as unenthusiastic instead of deconstructing what had gone wrong. The other thing that went on, Ethan, was that surprisingly, I'm not going to say who, hopefully people listen to the episode, but a number of voices spoke up in favor of Mike over Pop. And those voices were very influential in Colangelo's mind. And that had to do with Krzyzewski getting the job also.
I mean, I was joking about the Nike conspiracy theory, but you're just fueling it, you know, but you were saying, Jay.
well, one thing that we learned from this, and it's interesting how the fates of teams and leagues and organizations can turn on conversations like that. So that's a significant example that comes out through the course of the interviews and the conversations we have for this podcast. But we also recount several conversations of Mike Krzyzewski going to Kobe's room for a meeting that could have gone a number of different ways, and they wind up mending fences that way. Some concerns that Krzyzewski raises with Kobe as they're getting ready to start the Olympics in Beijing. Or meetings that they have in which a player speaks up and it could be interpreted one way and instead everyone else falls in line. And in Kobe's career, some meetings that he has with Phil Jackson, and in particular, one conversation that enabled them to reunite after they had a horrendous breakup. And then Phil trashes Kobe in his book and reveals how he wanted to get him traded. That's one of the things that it still amazes me, Ethan, is how after that split in 2004, the breakup of the Lakers, Kobe, Shaq, and Phil go their separate ways, how a year later, Kobe and Phil come together, and then they turn that into a highly successful pairing in which they win two more championships. And we get into that in the podcast. But one thing that enabled that to happen was the conversations that were held, and Phil narrows it down to a single conversation that they had when he said, okay, I'm thinking about coming back. I got to talk to Kobe and I got to see if we can make this work. And they had that conversation, and Phil comes away convinced, based on one request that Kobe had for him, that Phil said, yes, I can accommodate that. And given that, they decide they can make this work based on that one conversation. It was obviously a necessary conversation. But it like, look how that affects NBA history. There's two championships right there out of the last decade that come about from that conversation.
That's remarkable. What was the request?
Don't talk about me publicly. As Phil was wont to do, Phil was never shy about calling out his guys in the media. And so they get back together. And if it's going to happen, Kobe says, hey, I just have one thing I want from you. Can you not call me out in the press? I know you like to do that. Don't do that with me. And Phil said, okay, I can do that.
Phil was so good at that, like back in the day, that sometimes you didn't even know he was doing it. You'd write it, and you'd talk to Phil, and you'd write it, and you'd go, oh, yeah, I get what he's doing here with Pippen or with or once
Jack,
in a while.
There was a famous time he did it with Shaq. Yeah, so he really threw Shaq under the bus one time. Shaq had been sort of taking his time coming back from an injury, which – he was sort of known to do, but so one time Phil calls him out and says, Phil says, well, I've been told medically he's cleared to play. And he puts that out there at after a shoot around in the morning. And so I jump on it and I said that, hey, Phil says he can play. He needs to play. The team needs him. There's playoff seating and playoff berths at stake here. He's got to get back out there. And then Phil, by the time he meets with the media before the game that night, says, you know, I really shouldn't have said that. I was out of place to say that. And so Phil walked it back. But by then it was too late, right? And so I go up to Shaq and I say, hey, Shaq, I felt the need to apologize because based on what Phil had said, I had gone after Shaq. And I go up to Shaq and say, hey, Shaq, man. And before I can say it, he says, you're killing me. And I said, well, you know, Phil said he's fuck Phil. So I remember that time specifically. And Shaq was mad at Phil for a while after that, but again, they were able to reconcile too. Never underestimate the ability of people to reconcile. And you saw it, Ethan. I think the most famous example might be the fact that Chris Webber came back and played for Don Nelson in Golden State after the horrendous split they had after his rookie season there. And I don't think people talk about that enough, but Chris Webber, go back and look at everything, all the bad blood that was spilled between those two parties in the mid-90s. And then, in fact, in the 2000s, Chris Webber comes back and wears a Golden State uniform and plays for Don Nelson once again. So everything in sports, I believe, can be mended.
I can't wait for Steve Kerr and Kevin Durant to reunite. Well, you know what? I'm reminded of that weird dynamic, how coaches are often manipulating players. And the players know they're being manipulated and they know what the coaches are doing, but yet it still has an effect. I think that's what was happening in 2019. The way Steve was talking about Kevin Durant, the way he was saying that we just need him to score. And then KD would say, that's not the kind of player I am. I just want to make the right pass. And yet he had been challenged. And if you noticed right before that injury he suffered against the Rockets, he was scoring like crazy. And I think Kerr was saying, look, he kills me in the press. He undermines me when I message like this, and he doesn't like it, but he goes out there and he's shooting the ball as much as I want him to. So with some of those higher level coaches, it is interesting to me to see how it plays out where they can manipulate and the subject can know that they're being manipulated, and yet somehow it still serves a purpose.
No matter all these relationships, almost all the ones I've seen over the years, where there is a tension between a superstar player or any player and the coach still matters, this player. There's something about that little authority or father figure or whatever, the player still finds it important what the coach has to say. you know, no matter. And Darren Williams talked about this a little bit, and him and Jerry Sloan were, you know, knocking heads. And when it's all over, usually, I don't know whether Latrell Sprewell would say that about Pete, but there's exceptions. Believe there's always exceptions. But, you know, Darren was like, you know, it was never as bad. And I loved playing for Jerry, and I respect it, and I still have a place in Utah. That relationship between the player and coach is very hard to completely – you'll never completely get a player to pretend – he might pretend it. The coach is always an important part of his life, but just because of minutes.
But when the Jeff, coach
one,
has
one
to
thing is, I learned, just the time when I was working as a sideline reporter for ESPN, and one of the best parts of that job is the great access that we would get to the coaches. We'd sit and talk, and Popovich, believe it or not, was the best when we'd meet with him before the game. But we sit and talk in the coach's office for 10 minutes or so before the game, and we just get unfiltered, full perspective and insight from them on their team and the dynamics of their team. And through the course of doing that, I came to realize one of the most important elements of the NBA is, and it's a basic thing, but can the coach say, do this, without the key player saying, fuck you? And if you have that, if you can get past that, if the coach can say, do this, and the key players say, okay, I'll do it, that's the hallmark of a successful team. And if you don't have that camaraderie, it ain't going to work.
Right.
But the coach, I was going to say, the coach has to have the balls to do that and has to risk his job, has to risk being turned on. You talked about what Phil Jackson was doing to Shaq. I mean, how many coaches would dare try that, right? You have to have a certain level of gravitas, and it's hard to have that. You need to have some fuck you money. You need to have the kind of personality to try it. There are only so many coaches.
Deep down, Shaq wanted that, and Phil was smart enough to understand the psychology of Shaq. Shaq grew up with an Army sergeant father. He wanted that discipline, even though he might not have been the most disciplined person, certainly in comparison with Kobe, for example. He craved that discipline, and Shaq wanted Phil Jackson to be the coach, and Shaq felt they needed that type of leader, and that's why Phil worked where Del Harris hadn't with the similar players or similar roster, was that Phil brought accountability because he was on a multi-year contract, you know, the highest paid coach in the game at that time. He wasn't going anywhere. If they went on a 5-10 game losing streak, it wasn't going to be Phil Jackson that was going to be out of there. And so the players became accountable. Phil knew it and Shaq knew it. And that's why that relationship worked. And that's why Phil could get away with doing stuff that other coaches wouldn't dare try to accomplish in calling out their players publicly.
Well, everybody wants the imposition of boundaries, if nothing else, because it gives you then something to rebel against. Nobody wants to live in just chaos, or you make the rules. It's too much. I mean, maybe some people do, but not many even superstars. But I feel like we're missing a big component in the story you guys are covering and talking about this. Are you going to build up Spain, Team Spain, to be, I don't know what kind of level, the Russian hockey team in 1980? Like, how are you talking about Team Spain? What role do they have to play in your podcast series?
Well, 3 days ago, it's funny you asked that. 3 days ago, JA and I haven't recorded the whole thing yet. To a certain extent, we're, you know, Butch Cassidy and Sundance looking back at the posse coming. I mean, we're about, we're 2 weeks ahead, but we're not, you know, 6 weeks ahead. We just talked about, should we have an episode about the gold medal game? Or should it be just Beijing should be an episode and Spain's just another team? So the answer to your question is more like how you framed it. Spain, and it wasn't Argentina. It could have been Argentina coming in, but it wasn't. Manu got hurt in what would have been, you know, the semis, you know, Final Four. So it's Spain, and Spain is badass. Spain doesn't care. Spain's got their own seven players who are in the NBA. So I'd say we're kind of building them up that way. And the gold medal game, which we're going to look forward to looking at together. Unfortunately, we can't play Olympic highlights unless JA and I want to take $1 million out of our own pocket, because that's how much it costs to secure the rights. But that was one hell of a game. And in retrospect, when you look back, if there was a big game in the history of international basketball, it's not any of the Dream Team games. It's that Redeem Team beating Spain, a hell of a team, in the gold medal game.
I think if I can, this is exciting because this is still a live product. I can help you produce the podcast potentially. I really want to know how much pain there was on the other side of this story, because as much as redemption mattered to the American players, you're more of an underdog if you're Team Spain, and they got tantalizingly close to beating Goliath. And I just wonder how some of those guys, Gasol, for instance, looks back on that and how they experienced that defeat.
We are efforting to get that side of the story.
We're trying.
That's all we can say now.
Let me give you more obvious ideas that you're already pursuing. I think that would be very helpful to the endeavor.
A key moment for Kobe Bryant too, and that's where he asserts himself as the capo di tutti, so to speak. It's his show, and that completes the arc. And one of the things that was fascinating to me about this whole story is that the redemption of this team and of USA basketball is also synchronized, you could say, with the redemptive arc of Kobe Bryant. And this really represents his peak. So 2008 to 2010 really represents the triumph of Kobe's the most valuable player in 2008, wins the gold medal and is the hero of the gold medal game at the 2008 Olympics, and then proceeds to win championships the next two seasons and wins the finals MVP the next two seasons. So this 3-year period, 2008 to 2010, really represents the crowning achievements of Kobe Bryant's career. And this gold medal game is one of it. And the symbolism of what it meant for his place in the league as the key players are coming together to try to restore USA basketball to prominence. There's also this sort of internal intra-squad jockeying for who's the best player on the team and who's the best player in the NBA. And that's all going on. And the episode we just recorded, we talk about that. And to everyone's credit, they didn't let that tear the team apart. It very easily could have, this fight for internal supremacy. And to Kobe and LeBron and Coach K's credit, they figured out a way for them to all come together for the benefit of the team. Dwayne Wade, I think, plays a big role in that too.
I'm curious because you had such a connection with Kobe. I remember being at Staples and Kobe came back that night and he just walked right on up to you. And have you guys had that rapport? Did he talk about this experience often with you? Did you have a lot of conversations about it?
Believe it or not, I didn't. And I'm trying to think why I didn't speak to him much when he came back from that gold medal in 2008. We did talk in 2007 and 2012 when they're in Las Vegas. I remember talking to him at those moments. And in particular, 2012, there's a lot of Dream Team versus modern Olympic team and who would win. And I remember having a conversation with Kobe about that in 2012. And Kobe at that point had sort of moved on to he was more the spokesman of that team. I think he recognized that he was no longer the best player on that team. That was LeBron and Kevin Durant had surpassed him, but he was going to be the most outspoken member of that team. And we talked about that a little bit. What's interesting, Ethan, is we didn't talk about Beijing that much, even after he came back, because it just felt like enough time had passed that by the time he got back, it just felt like it was onto the season. There were high hopes and aspirations. They'd lost in the finals that year. So Kobe, he comes back and he's on a mission that year to win that championship. He'd been humiliated. It's funny. And so he has this peak over the summer, but then he comes back and he's reminded the last time he was in an NBA uniform, the last time he wore his Lakers jersey, he gets humiliated in Boston, walking off the court in Boston Garden. They get blown out in that game six. And so he's back in that mode. So he wasn't all, happy and reminiscing about Beijing and the gold medal. He's already back in attack mode trying to get that NBA championship. So I think that's the reason why he and I didn't spend a lot of time reminiscing about Beijing.
I think also part of the reason that it's hard, that this amazing job that like Krzyzewski and Colangelo did, was They used to, the editor at Sports Illustrated used to have a saying, nothing is as over as the Olympics the day after. It's very hard to keep instilling that because these guys come back and it's like, okay, now our real job, you know, is in front of us. And, you know, the way it's going now, the way things are scheduled, they got only a couple weeks before it starts again. So to keep that kind of, and nothing is as on as the Olympics during those 20 days, those 19 or 20 days, you know, but it's over and then it's over again and people forget about it. But guys like Jerry Colangelo and Krzyzewski can't forget about it. And that group that got together for Redeem Team didn't forget about it either. He told us that Carmelo during the year would call Colangelo up and say, hey, how am I doing? You know, this is what Colangelo said. I mean, maybe there was only one call. I don't know. Mm. But that consistency of trying to keep it, you know, not everybody does it. And that's one of the things that these guys did between those summers of 05 and 08 to get this thing back on track.
But what amazes me, Ethan, is as we talk to these guys now, and it's amazing how many have moved on now. Carmelo is the only one that we spoke to who's still in the league. And it's a testament to LeBron that he's the defending champion right now. And this was 12 years ago. And 12 years later, he's still at the top of the NBA and the top of the basketball world. But as these guys have moved on now, and even Carmelo, who's still playing and still has NBA goals to pursue, the fondness that they have, the vividness of the memories and the details that they can recall. And all of that speaks to what a special moment that was, and moments really, right? Because it was 2006, 7, and 8 for a lot of those guys. But the details that Mike Krzyzewski had, as he recalled for us, the specifics that he could remember, and the fondness that he had for those guys and for that time that they spent together is really evident. And we could hear it as we talked to him, and I think it's really clear and evident as you listen to Mike Krzyzewski talk on the podcast.
Is that the motivation? I mean, what was the motivation? Was it patriotism? Was it these guys who decided to turn this ship around, the humiliation that they felt over what had happened in 2004? It almost feels like it's of a simpler time, if I take it at face value, that they wanted to restore the international reputation of American basketball. Is that what you got from your conversations with them as to why they all wanted to take this project on?
No doubt about it. There's no doubt that 2004 figured heavy in the minds of of LeBron, Melo, and D. Wade. There's different reasons all the time. In 92, the Dream Team, different. The first time, we're not going to lose. Michael's on board. You could sense that it was, that everybody knew, even as dumb as sports writers are, that this is something special. This is the first time, you know, this is the Revolutionary War. This is the kickoff. And that happened again. And I think the patriotic part of it, J.A. could disagree with me, but the patriotic part of it, I think, is kind of sensed. But I think that was built in later. And a lot of the things that Krzyzewski did in the buildup, 2006, 2007, having the military come in, having these, you know, generals. Krzyzewski can get anybody he wants from that part of the world. And, you know, it's a danger doing that a little bit, the equation of war and basketball and military, particularly somebody like me who, you know, went to college in the 60s. But to these guys, there is absolutely no question that it worked. And yes, that became part of the thing also, even though I would say from the beginning, that wasn't the thing. It was putting the U.S. back on top.
But they all bought into that. And Krzyzewski's use of the Marvin Gaye national anthem from the 1983 All-Star Game, and he played that repeatedly, and they bought into that. And the flag and the USA on their chest and all of that, it all worked at that time. And when we spoke to these guys later, none of them said, oh, it was kind of hokey. They all bought into it and playing for something bigger than yourselves. And they all responded to that really well. I wonder, Ethan, again, as we talk about how can we sort of recreate that 2008 moment and that spirit, it's so different right now. And the anthem itself is a controversy, and whether or not to stand, would there be someone who would kneel on the podium if they win the gold medal and they're playing the Star Spangled Banner? Would someone kneel or raise a fist or do something? That's all on the table right now after what we've been through the last few years. And so if there's not the notion of playing for your country, if that's been taken away, if people are questioning their belief in America and what America stands for, and all the stuff that the pandemic has revealed about the inequality in this country and the racial turmoil that we've experienced the last year or so. So how do you reconvene and get that spirit back? So the 92 mission of the Dream Team was really about basketball and the NBA. And David Stern was able to get everyone convinced, and Jack can speak to this in greater detail than I can, but that was about everyone's convinced that if we do this, it will be good for the game. And we'll help grow the sport. Ultimately, you will all benefit from that. You will all profit from that. But if you care about basketball and you want to spread the gospel of basketball, then let's put on this showcase. Let's show them how we do it in America. Let's show them what basketball at its highest level can look like. And we'll make this the world sport, or at least the number two after soccer. And I think that's grudgingly why Michael went along, Jack. Is that why you would say? Magic was certainly all in. And I think Bird sort of said, okay. And Michael said, okay.
I don't mean this in a critical way. It's more descriptive, but it was almost a colonialist venture, it seemed, in 92 versus what it was in 2008.
Yeah, and the reverse happened. And that was the biggest effect. I'm sure that, you know, somewhere along the lines, somebody got more dollars in an international contract than they would have. But the biggest effect was the freedom or liberation of the other countries. And that was, it enabled them to, the phrase I always use was, and I didn't say it at the time, it demystified the game. That all those 12-year-old Dirk Nowitzkis and Manu Ginobili's and Hajdu Turkoglu's and Tony Parker's and you name it were over there going, well, you know, they do the same stuff we do. They pass the screen away. They box out. They make a diagonal pass to find the open guy. They just do it 50 times better. And that is exactly what the guy, Boris Stankovic, whose idea it was, you know, Yugoslavian basketball official. Until the pros play this, we're not going to really see this game get bigger. That was exactly what he said. And everybody said, no, you're full of crap. The United States is going to win every game by 50 points, which happened, but the other thing happened also.
Yeah.
And that's the great lesson of the Dream Team.
I think, I mean, to what Jay is saying, yeah, that can happen on the stage. Players might express themselves in a way that is critical of their own country. I don't think that you can or should control that. You know, people should do what they want to do. But I do think Adam Silver has erred in a way on this. I do think it's been a blind spot for him. Obviously, just like David Stern, he wants to internationalize the game and make money off that. I mean, that's obvious. But I think in pursuing that, he's lost sight of just messaging and what you should say that resonates domestically. And when I was at the finals and he's on the stage and he's saying that he really wants there to be a superstar in the NBA from China, and it's a big disappointment to him, and that they're trying to work with China to get them to perform better in the Olympics. I'm looking around going, dude, I don't think you understand how this is coming off to people. This is not a good look. This is not a good look for you. And so,
the fascinating thing about that, and you know, we really dove into this after the Daryl Morey tweet and the whole NBA China story from the start of last year. It's hard to believe that was the same season as the pandemic and all that. But that was the number one issue at the start of the 2019-20 season.
Yeah.
And I apologize, I can't remember the writer that said this, but he really made the good point that the NBA and U.S. businesses in general thought that, okay, by engaging with China, we can spread American values to China, most notably capitalism, but also maybe American democratic ideals to China. And instead, the reverse happened, right? That we were forced to abide by, China said, okay, if you're going to play over here, if you're going to do business with us, you're going to do so under our rules and our guidelines. And that includes, if you have a tweet that goes against the Chinese government, we're shutting everything down. And so the lesson was that, okay, we can engage and we can try to tap into all of the obvious consumers that there are in China, but it's going to cost you because you're going to have to do so. You're going to have to do so under their ideas of politics and and restraint and censorship and all of that.
There's no free lunch, or rarely is there a free lunch.
Yeah. Not to put this all on Adam, but I went back during that whole contretemps that was going on and dug up this story I did on David Stern.
I read it. It was great.
And David's, I still remember exactly where we are. We're in the Moscow airport. And back then they were just starting. I was going on this sort of Stern over the world tour in the preseason. And he let me come along with much trepidation. And I said to him, well, what about your new burgeoning relationship with human rights violator China? And he just, his face just darkened. Oh, God, McCallum, do we have to, you know, I hear this at home from my wife, you know, and he just about said in this paragraph, well, yeah, I'm violating my own principles, but I'm trying to make money for my owners. And it was sort of like the ultimate bottom line of the, if you want to call it a conundrum, or if you want to call it the, you know, essential hypocrisy of being a commissioner of a league, that you are putting aside whatever values you may ascribe to yourself in pursuit of the dollar. And that remains a problem.
I would just give him at least credit for being honest on it, because I think a lot of people sold themselves on this idea that they would change China in the way JA was saying by exporting America to China. And it was about the money that was the primary motivating factor, but they wrapped themselves into this whole concept to make it noble that they were changing the world in some way that I just don't think is the case.
Events always get in the way. You know, a protest that went on, as brave a protest that went on, you know, Stern didn't know that back then. Events always get in the way. You know, you start out one way and boy, it just turns into the Shakespeare line, when once we, you know, set out to deceive, you know, what a tangled web we weave. And that's what Adam Silver's in right now.
Can we talk about the project that you're working on vis-a-vis Stern? I mean, maybe we edit this out. I have no idea. But you reached out to me to fork over my audio conversations with David Stern. I became very curious as to what you're up to.
Well, like most projects, it remains out there in the we just thought he would be a fascinating subject for a look at, you know, either a documentary or a podcast. But so far with the pandemic world, it has not been able yet to come to fruition. But Stern, like myself, as I started reaching out to people, there was like 10 different people at least that said what I did. You know, I always ask Stern if he wanted to do a book. He never would do it, because he was one of those guys that could have told tales. It could have been a business oriented book. It could have been an amazing personal story. You know, it could have been a lot of different things, but Stern didn't want to do it. And it's still out there, Ethan, and it's not near fruition.
You know what, Jack? I miss the David Stern contempt and the David Stern the way he would look at you. I just pictured it as you're describing that interview with him at the Moscow airport. And man, do I miss that. And it's funny, a David Stern USA basketball memory that I have is from 2007. I'd just been hired by ESPN, and David Stern is going to have a press conference in conjunction with Team USA's activities in Vegas. They have training camp there, and then they're going to play the FIBA Americas tournament there in 2007, the Olympic qualifying tournament. And it also was Stern's first media availability after the Tim Donaghy scandal had broken. So I go up there to catch Stern's press conference, and I'm walking up to him either before or after the press conference. And he comes up and he takes my credential, Jay Donde, ESPN, and he just pretends to cross it off. You know, I'd just written a column. I think I bashed him in the NBA pretty good over the Donaghy stuff. And he just takes my credential, looks at it, and then with his finger, just just crosses it off. Like, he X'd me out. Like, you're out, Adande. I miss David, man.
Oh, man. Just fun to argue with. I like the sense of almost combat in a conversation and the give and the take and just this.
And a worthy opponent.
Oh, yeah.
A most worthy opponent.
They say in improv that you're supposed to try to perform at the top of your intelligence. It felt like in those conversations, okay, it's like I'm on stage. I'm being challenged. I'm being challenged really hard. I'm being yelled at. I'm being yelled at right now. I'm being asked to define words. It was a glorious experience, frankly, and I miss it. So I guess to close out, I asked this question. And Jack just steamrolled me like a pro, immediately went back to pitching the product and didn't fall for my question about the trippy, heady question I had of where we're all at. So I'll direct it at JA and maybe Jack can follow up. What do you make of this right now, this time that we're in, where there seems to be exponentially more interest in the past and in NBA nostalgia than in the NBA present?
I think it can all be tied together. It's obviously a great deal of it is we'd much rather look at the past than look at this horrendous present that they're dealing with right now in this uncertain future. So there's always a value to nostalgia. I would say there's never been a greater value to nostalgia, at least for my generation and below, than we're going through right now. Maybe if you'd lived through World War II, or the Great Depression, it would have been different. But for people age 50 and below, I'll say, the nostalgia has never been more appealing. Escapism has never been more appealing. Returning to a better time has never been more appealing. And so that has to do with this content. I think that is leading to the resurgence of the collectibles market and rookie Michael Jordan cards. And we've seen it building for a while in terms of the retro Air Jordan market for that, which has been booming for several years and really took off after The Last Dance. But it's also our turn to be nostalgic. So when I was a 10-year-old, let's say late 70s, early 80s, we were dealing with the baby boomers' nostalgia for the 50s. You look at the cultures, Happy Days, Grease, the movie, Motown music made a comeback in the early 1980s. And so now I'd say it's Generation X's time to be nostalgic. And in particular, the 90s Bulls, 90s music, 90s television, Stranger Things, capitalizing on looking back on the 80s and how popular that Stranger Things series was on Netflix, retro, nostalgia, all of that. So part of it is that it's Generation X's turn to be nostalgic. And we have control over a lot of the creative endeavors that are out there. And we're turning back to what makes us feel good and what our good memories are. And that's the 80s and the 90s. And before you know it, it'll be the millennials' turn and we'll have nostalgia for the early 2000s. And so maybe we're ahead of the game with this nostalgic look back at 2008. It's a little out of sync with where the culture is right now, but I think we're a little ahead. And like you said at the outset, Ethan, sometimes it's kind of cool to do an early retrospective. And so you could view this as an early look back at a period of time that's not too long ago, but long enough now that there's some distance and there's some additional perspective and some wisdom that we can apply to this look back.
What you think, Jack?
Well, on a sports level, I think that's all correct. When I teach college, and that's something that JA does, for a goddamn living, but I do it,
when I'm not podcasting, Jack,
when you're not podcasting, and with the money in podcasting, by the way, you're not doing that for a living. But anyway, I always say to my students, I am astounded each year that I do this. The last time I did it was last year. Why their point of reference in when we talk about basketball, and they know that's primarily what I am. That's not what the course is about, but it comes up. Why do they emphasize Jordan as much? More. They got LeBron. They got Steph Curry. They got Harden. They have KD. They got these iconic figures with a personality and a biography. And I'm fascinated every year why it comes to Jordan. And the answer I kind of get is regrettably, and maybe that's too strong, it has a lot to do with commercialism. That Jordan not only exists as this Arturian legend as a basketball player, but his sneakers are still, it's what we want. They've become so iconic that he's like a commercial brand, that he's an illusion and also a commercial brand. And it really astonishes me, and it makes me understand again how lucky I was to be covering these guys, Jordan in particular, but also Magic and Bird and all that come along with them, you know, that were these once in a generation players. Having said that, though, and this is my final word, from a personal level, being closer to the grave, much closer to the grave than any other part of life, the pandemic has caused something different, that it's been a reckoning for, I think, more people my age to come to really embrace the future more, honestly, that I look forward now to more, just because this year has been like no other. It's caused you to have reckoning with your relationships, with your wife, with your kids, in my case, with your grandkids, with your old friends. And it's really caused the kind of thing that you're not necessarily looking back, that you want to build those relationships stronger going forward. But that is totally the product of my age. And in many ways, it's been exciting, might be too strong of a word, but it's been different, and I've kind of embraced it. And if that's not explained very well, probably someone closer to my age, which is early 70s, can understand it.
I mean, you're almost not being allowed to get older, though, just because there's such intense interest in what you were covering decades ago. I just pulled this up because I found it so interesting. It was Michael Jordan talking to Rick Talander, I think, in 1998. And he says, I've heard people say I'm the Babe Ruth of this half of the 20th century. I don't know. Most recognized athlete? It seems that way. But man, it's lasted a lot longer than I anticipated. I never thought it would go on like this. I'll tell you, to remain a positive model in the public eye for so long, it takes a toll. It takes a big chunk of you. You wanted to die out, but now it's so deep. It's a big responsibility that just goes on and on. I see other players, other NBA stars who can take some of the responsibility. Grant Hill, Kobe Bryant to some degree. But still, a lot of that burden is on me. That's from 1998, and it doesn't feel like it's changed too much, or am I crazy?
He told me that in back something like that, that he told Rick. He told me that in 1991, we gave him Sportsman of the Year. And it was right around the time that things were starting to turn a little bit for Michael. He hadn't gone to the White House. He was involved with Slim Buhler. Sam Smith's book, The Jordan Rules, had come out. And I had this interview with Michael in which he talked about, you know, I hadn't realized everybody didn't want a positive role model, that people would start to get sick of it, you know? And that was like, I have that moment as a sort of a demarcation in Michael's career, that before that, it was always the boyish kid that you could always get and was great. And then in like when all this happened around summer of 91, after he won his first title, it's when his ability as a basketball player just catapulted. I mean, you know, he won three in a row, takes off, wins three in a row again, which J.A. helped chronicle in the you know, in both the podcast and the television show. But even before he reached that level, Michael was starting to have a reckoning with that. And this is 2021. 2021. And we are still talking about this guy as a sports cultural figure that, with the exception of Ali, who did not have a sneaker line, will never be matched. And it's really extraordinary. And when I look back on it, it's just my fortune. And it, lately, you know, J.A. had the fortune of being there for Kobe, that we're, to a certain extent, we are the product of who we covered. And nobody had it luckier than I did. Nobody.
He, he's almost celebrity Encino man, that he's got these 14 shoes, shoes I would often see J.A. wearing, in addition to his suit,
as a
sideline reporter. Yeah, which always would drive Mark Stein crazy for some reason. Well, now Stein was driven more crazy when I would wear the shoes. But anyway, that he's selling these 14 shoes, they're all from his Chicago Bulls playing days. If he makes a new shoe, people don't really want it so much. Maybe there are some people who want it, but what they want is 1990s Michael Jordan Chicago Bulls, and he can sell that forever. And he can sell more of that than anybody today can sell of anything. It is fascinating that he is frozen in our cultural consciousness in this way that might even be unique. I can't even find a comparison to it. And I think your theory is correct on it, that it has something to do with how advertising at that moment boomed. I would also hypothesize that it was maybe the second peak of American power. The 1990s, relative to other eras, was a really good time for the United States economically in terms of its pride. The Vietnam War at that point had been a long time before. And so there's something to that era where it just does not go away. And maybe we'll see something similar when it comes to this recent era of LeBron and Kobe and the Redeem team. I think you guys are doing a killer job with this. I am so excited to listen to the rest of the series. And also, it's just good to see generational rivals, Boomers and Gen X, teaming up on a project. So that's very inspiring.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Ethan. It's been a blast.
And thanks, Millennial.
Indeed. A big thanks to Jay Adonde and Jack McCollum. Check out their podcast. Big thanks to Jade, who's doing an incredible job producing this podcast and others. Big thank you to the listeners. We will be back next week. Stay safe out there. Enjoy the NBA. Can't wait to return. See you, everybody.